A testimony is a strange thing. I told Paula before we left the house, this is the first time in 5 years I've actually been nervous. So bear with me this morning or this evening and listen to what the Lord can do. That's what this is all about. You know, I couldn't help but thinking as I was looking on the stage at Maria as she was worshiping God and crying, and Tracy, whose face beams with the joy of the Lord as she's worshiping the Lord. I couldn't help but to think, you know, that's my testimony. You guys are my testimony. You're the fruit of everything that God has done in my life. And I feel like King David sometimes, not in the kingly way, but as he must have felt when our king wrote from the heart of a shepherd and said, "Oh Lord, hear my prayer. Listen to my cry for mercy. In your faithfulness and righteousness, come to my relief. Do not bring your servant into judgment, for no one living is righteous before you. The enemy pursues me. He crushes me to the ground. He makes me dwell in darkness like those long dead. So my spirit grows faint within me. My heart within me is dismayed. I remember the days of long ago. I meditate on all your works and consider what your hands have done. I spread out my hands to you. My soul thirsts for you like a parched land. Answer me quickly, O Lord. My spirit fails. Do not hide your face from me, or I will be like those who go down to the pit. Let the morning bring me word of your unfailing love, for I have put my trust in you. Show me the way I should go. For to you I lift up my soul. Rescue me from my enemies, O Lord, for I hide myself in you. Teach me to do your will, for you are my God. May your good spirit lead me on level ground. For your name's sake, O Lord, preserve my life. In your righteousness, bring me out of trouble. In your unfailing love, silence my enemies. Destroy all my foes. For I am your servant." Father, be glorified tonight. And by the power of your Spirit, Lord, use me to demonstrate that you can use anyone. May your name be magnified. May your name be exalted. May our spirits within us be lifted as we look to the heavens, to a God of mercy, righteousness, and justice. We love you and we praise you. In your name we pray. Amen. Would you turn in your Bibles quickly to Matthew chapter 20? I'm going to begin reading in verse 25. Let me give you just a little bit of background. Our Lord is coming toward the end of His ministry, and some strange things are happening. Finally, for about the fourth time, He's explained to His followers that He's going to go to Jerusalem where He's going to be killed. Now, you guys, the disciples were a lot like you and I are. You know, they didn't believe Him. They didn't truly understand the depth of the things that Jesus was saying. They didn't truly understand the sacrifice on their behalf that was about to take place. And though He told them time and time again what to expect, it just didn't sink in. Sometimes that's the way it is with the Lord and the work He's trying to do in our lives. Well, in this particular incident in John, or Matthew chapter 20 rather, the two disciples, John and James, decide to kind of break ranks with the rest of the group, but they wanted to do it kind of undercover. You know, when you know you're doing something you shouldn't do, you're kind of sneaky about it. Well, that's what happened, and here's what they did. Now, these are two good Jewish boys, and their mother, a perfect Jewish mother who can do guilt with the best of them, says, "Boys, do you want me?" And they say, "Mother, we have a favor to ask. Would you do this one thing for us?" "Well, sure. What would you have me do?" And they said this. They said, "Go to Jesus for us. You see, He's going to come into His kingdom soon. We're sure of that. And Mother, we can't ask them. You know how it would be if the other disciples, our friends, would see us. They wouldn't be too pleased with us if they saw us maneuvering for favor with the Lord. So Mother, here's what I want you to do. Would you get Jesus alone and ask Him to grant us, your sons, favor?" John, because he was the disciple whom Jesus loved, I am sure said, Mother, I want to be on his right side when he comes into the kingdom. In other words, I want to be in the position of power. I want to be in that place where I'm never far away from Jesus at all. I want to be in that place where Jesus can always depend on me. And James would have said, well, he's my brother and he's my Lord. So Mother, ask Jesus if I can have the place on his left when he comes into the kingdom. And with that background, verse 25, Jesus says, or the narrative says, Jesus called them together and said. Now, the reason he called them together is because the disciples' scheme didn't work. John and James were discovered. The other 10 found out. And the Bible says they were indignant. Literally, they were furious with rage. So Jesus, trying to restore peace, called them together. And as he always does, he gave them heaven's perspective. He said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Now, John and James must have started sweating at this point. You know, they're sitting out there, we're busted here. Because that's exactly what they were trying to do. They were trying to maneuver to gain position. But Jesus said, not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. Now, this verse is important to me, and I hope it's going to be important to some of you, because Jesus gives us a clue about something that I believe is inborn in each and every one of us. You see, it's okay to want to be great. That's exactly what the inference is here. It's okay to want to be great. It is a mechanism, I believe, that God builds within each of us. You remember the time when you were a child and you thought there was something great in your future. We all believe from earliest recollection that we were going to be special, that there was something so special about us, so unique, so absolutely unavailable in any other human, that we had to be destined for something great. And it's a good thing as long as your greatness, your desire for it, is focused on Jesus. Sadly, for most of us, that isn't the way it is. We want to be great, but we want to be great for us. Now, because I wasn't raised in a Christian home, I believe that my greatness was going to come in a couple of different ways. You know, when you're a little kid and you see the president on the TV and you think, oh man, I want to be like him. Now, you guys have to excuse me, because I go back a few years. My first recollection of an American president was Dwight D. Eisenhower. Don't laugh. And I remember the flap in our country when Richard Nixon and John Kennedy were debating on television. And the election was so close, nobody could rightly predict the winner. The stakes were so high. And all of this attention on him, I thought, that's it. How old do you have to be president, Mom? She said, 35. I said, that's me. Well, as you might know by now, that didn't work out. And it became obvious pretty soon that, well, being president really isn't what I was cut out for. So I had a plan B. I really like plan B. You see, plan B was playing shortstop for the Dodgers. I lived in Southern California where the Dodgers were absolutely king. And so I figured, well, obviously, I'm going to be great. I'm going to play shortstop for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Everybody will know me. The kids will want my autograph. I'll be on radio. I'll be on TV. Everybody will want to know who I am. Well, the problem with that was I was a little short on the talent department. It took me 25 years to figure it out. But I was a little short on the talent department, so that wasn't going to work out at all. But that inborn quality that seeks greatness is in every one of us. And you know what? As I look back from the perspective of heaven, I look back and I see something that is absolutely wonderful. I absolutely was destined for greatness. But greatness for the kingdom of God. You see, that's what Jesus said in verse 26. He said, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. Now, look at the way he turns everything in the world upside down. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. The next verse says, the same verse says, and to give his life as a ransom for many. You see, Jesus said, follow my example. Let your attitude, Philippians chapter 2, be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who considered equality with God not something to be held on to. He made himself of no reputation. Isn't it true that we spend a great deal of our lives trying to make a reputation for ourselves for all the wrong reasons? Well, Jesus was saying something in this passage of Scripture to his disciples that they would need to learn. He's saying something to you and me tonight that we need to learn. That if we want to be first, we must be last. If we want to be great, we must be the servant of all. Guys, it took me 39 years to learn that lesson. I didn't grow up in a church home. My grandmother was a Christian, but nobody knew it. Now, I'm not being hard on my grandmother. She loved God with all of her heart. But you see, at that particular time, it just wasn't culturally acceptable to be public about your faith. My grandmother was a Midwestern woman from Iowa who incidentally prayed for me all of her years of life. She prayed for me and her other grandchildren. And I attribute my being here today in large part due to her prayer. You should have heard the beautiful poetry that she wrote that we found out about after she had gone to be with the Lord. But you see, my mother, her daughter, and my dad weren't Christians at that time in their life. I didn't grow up in church. At the time I got saved, guys, I'd never even read a Bible. The closest I'd come was a Gideon's Bible in a hotel room in Pomona, California. I had no idea what the Bible meant. You know, like everybody, you think, well, I ought to read it. I'd be a little familiar with it. But the thous and the therefores, I just couldn't make any sense of it. And I thought, I got better things to read. And I don't know how many of you date this far back, but Mad Magazine was real popular at the time. And so between Mad Magazine and Sports Illustrated, I was kept pretty busy. Oh, how ripped off I was if I'd only learned what a treasure there was in the Word of God. Well, my first church experience was with my grandmother as well. There was a pastor, Reverend Lee Pryor, in Pomona, California, at the First Christian Church. I didn't know anything about it. But two things struck me when I walked into church for the very first time. The first thing that struck me was how old the pastor was. It was absolutely incredible to me. I thought, you ought to be with God now. I mean, I had nothing that I could relate to with this man. And I looked around me and everybody was my grandma's age. And so it was obvious, even from a very early age, that church wasn't the place to be. Church was for old people. Now, it's true, church is for old people. It's just true also that church is for everybody. I just had no way of knowing it. That was the first impression. The second impression I had was that every time I went to church, I got a headache. And I didn't understand why. It was nothing spiritual. You see, my grandma made me wear a tie. And I get this tie, and I'd spend the whole thing going, and I'd have such a headache at the end of the Sunday school. And then we had to go into the worship service and listen to somebody yell at us. And I just didn't understand at all what value there was. And so the minute I got out, I'd rip my clip-on tie off and go out. And do we have to do that again? My mom would say, you know, Ronnie, when Grandma wants to go, we need to go. Well, fortunately, it wasn't very often. And my picture of church didn't change for a very long time. The first time it changed was not a positive change at all. It was a negative change. I grew up in a city called Pomona, California. And I grew up during the times of the hippie years. I grew up in a city during the time when race riots were common. In 1965, race riots tore apart Los Angeles, California. The famous Watts riots caused what was called then the urban flight. And inner city blacks from all over the country migrated to Southern California. Back then, there was a social phenomenon called blockbusting. And what it was, and there's great history books about this, what it was they would herd all of the minorities into particular neighborhoods. Well, it seems like many of them came to Pomona, my city, which by the time I was in the ninth grade was 85% white, overnight became 50% black. And there was incredible friction between the races. Now, the only thing that kept me from choosing sides was sports. I was an athlete. I played baseball. I played football. Believe it or not, I even played basketball. And no, it wasn't a midget league. It was just basketball. And there were blacks on the athletic teams. And so those of us who were involved in sports hung out together. We were friends. But everybody else in the high school was taking sides. In fact, everybody else in our city was taking sides. And there was racism running rampant in our city. Race riots and closures of our public high schools were common. Not just once in a while. They were very, very common. It was a very, very rough city. And I developed an interest in a girl named Rhonda. Rhonda was beautiful. She sang like a canary. It was just love at first sight, or so I thought. And I asked Rhonda to go on a date, and she said, well, you have to meet my mother first. Why do we? Now remember, I've got hair to my shoulders, and I'm kind of a baseball player, and I'm kind of a hippie, and I'm the last thing a mother wanted to see, talking to her about her daughter. Why do we have to go through all of this? And she said, well, my mother, if she doesn't approve, then we won't be able to go out. So I went to her house, and I said, Mrs. Newsham, I would like to date your daughter. Rhonda would like to date me, and I just came to tell you that we're going to begin dating. And she said, well, don't go so fast. She said, what church did you go to? You know what I said? First Christian Church. Hadn't been there since I was 8. But didn't matter. It was the only one that popped into my mind. And she said, well, when's the last time you went? Oh, you had to ask that question. No, I can't lie. I mean, it shows. And so I told her, well, it's my grandma's church, and I go with her sometimes, but it's been quite a while since I've gone. She said, well, if you want to begin dating my daughter, you need to come to our church. And I said, well, sure. What church is your church? And her church was Pomona First Baptist Church on Gary and Holt in Pomona, California. I thought, that's all I've got to do, give a Sunday morning, and Rhonda and me, we're an item. And so I went to church. But something began to develop in my heart at that first church. You see, being fairly liberal in what I believe socially and politically, in that time it was easy to be that way. I looked around and I started looking at the people in church. And over there was my high school vice principal, Mr. Cook, and I knew he was a racist. There was a football coach that I knew was a racist. I'd heard him with my own ears talking about the blacks that had moved into our city. I'd look at neighbors. I'd look at people that I knew. And I knew that they were sitting in the house of God with filth in their heart. And you know what I said right then? Rhonda, you're not worth it. I will not sit in this house filled with hypocrites 1 minute longer. These people claim to love God. And whatever understanding I have of God is that He is a loving God, and these people are not demonstrating anybody's kind of love. And I determined in my heart that I was never going to come back. And that was the end of my church experience until after I got saved in 1991. I only set foot in a church for two other reasons, an occasional funeral and my own wedding. You see, I didn't care anything about church because church was filled with people like you. People who told dirty stories when they weren't in church and who opened hymn books when they were in church. People who hated other human beings when they weren't in church and pretended to love everybody when they were in church. I wanted no part of that. Frankly, I still want no part of that. That's why it's so important to have a relationship with Jesus Christ. Well, my life changed radically, and it took the prettiest girl in the whole world to change it. 1970, I went to my old high school. By this time, I was a freshman in college, there to play baseball at San Fernando Valley State College in Northridge, California. Had a weekend off. My home was about 60 miles away from where I went to college. And I went home to watch my high school play basketball against Bonita High School. I didn't know anything about Bonita High School. I mean, we played basketball and football and baseball against them. But I didn't know Paula from anybody else at that particular time. And I went and I sat with a friend to watch my other friend play basketball. And as I recall, my high school was stomping her high school. But beyond that, I looked across the room and I saw this bouncing little cheerleader who absolutely took my breath away. And I was sitting next to a friend. His name was Larry. I said, Larry, you know her, don't you? And he said, yeah, that's Paula. I said, well, can you get her phone number for me? You know what he said? He goes, oh, Ron, you don't have a chance with her. I said, you watch. So he got her phone number, gave it to me. told her to expect my call. And a couple weeks went by, and on March 20th, 1970, I called her from the Valley, San Fernando Valley, and said, "Paula, my name is Ron Arbaugh. Did Larry tell you?" "Yes, he told me that you'd be calling." "Well, you know what? I thought we might be able to get together. I'm on my way home. I'll be there in about an hour. How about if you and I go out tonight?" You know what she said? She said, "Oh, well, thanks for calling, but I can't go out with you tonight because I already have a date." Now, I'm telling you this story to give you some insight into what was going on in my head and my heart relative to me at that time. You know what I said? She said, "I already have a date." And I said, "I'll call you back in a half hour. Break it." And she did. And she did. I got directions. I went to her house. I knocked on the door. She opened the door. And guys, we fell in love. In an instant. In an instant, we fell in love. It was as though we were meant to be together from the beginning of the foundations of the world. It was as though we were meant for each other. It was actually as though we had been looking for one another from that very, very first moment we were aware of the need for companionship. Now, we didn't understand any of what God was doing. We didn't even know God. But we fell in love in an instant. I got to Paula's house about 6 o'clock or so. I don't remember exactly what time it was. And we just sat and we talked and we actually kissed a little bit and some of the things, you know. And finally, I hear this voice. "It's time for you to go home." Well, that's how I met Paula's mother. See, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. And time just flew by. So I said, I'm sorry for staying too late. Paula, I'll pick you up in a few hours. You see, I'd made plans to go to the beach with my friends the next day on the weekend. I said, "Paula, I'll pick you up. Now, my friends will be there, but we're going to the beach." So we all drove down to the beach. I let my friends go off, and Paula and I spent the day together. We spent about 16 or 17 hours together every day that week. It was a vacation week. Guys, we were so in love that it was just crazy. It didn't make any sense at all. For me to have to go back to college was almost unthinkable. Now, I had to go. But I knew that I had met the woman. Paula knew she had met the man that we were going to spend the rest of our lives with. And it was scary. It was scary for me, but it was even scarier for her. And with the exception of 6 months, we have been together for the 31 years since that very time. Now, I'd love to tell you that the 31 years was a great time together, but it wasn't a great time at all. Because I made her life and mine and those around me miserable during most of those years. You see, my journey into destruction began with immaturity. I didn't know what to do. Because I met Paula and because Paula was black, my dad disowned me. I was one of those kids who was raised with new cars and credit cards and plenty of gas, you know, just an unlimited expense account. As long as I could play baseball, my dad was thrilled. And so I was his favorite son, and I got whatever I wanted. But when I came home and said, "Dad, I've found the woman," he says, "Oh, great, who is she?" And I told him, he said, "If you want her, you're not welcome in my house." "Okay, I'm leaving." He goes, "Well, you're walking because I'm taking the car." And that's exactly what I did. I walked out of my dad's house. And I was unwelcome back in his house until after he and my mother divorced. I was never allowed to go back in. He even forbid my family to have contact with me. My mother, my brother, and my sister. And so they would sneak around and do it. But he forbid me to have that kind of contact. I didn't understand. I wasn't ready to go out into the world. I was just an immature kid who had no idea about what making a living was. And so we struggled. We had no direction. We had nothing. We had no way to get around. And so Paula would work and I'd work a little bit. But I couldn't keep a job. You see, there was a problem. Every job I went to, there was a boss there. And I wasn't very good at taking directions. And when somebody would act disrespectfully toward me, I would either say something very unkind or, you know, I didn't like it. And you don't keep a job very long with that kind of an attitude. And so things got harder and harder and harder. And then one day, my life took another turn. I answered an ad out of desperation. I answered an ad. Car salesman wanted, will train, no experience necessary. Toyota of Pomona. And so I went for the interview. I thought, no experience necessary. Hey, that's me. I'm your guy. I went over and applied for the job. And the first thing the guy told me appealed to me so much. He said, Ron, do you know, his name was Tony, said, Ron, do you know that the car business is the only profession on earth where a lazy man can make a good living? Right then I was hooked. You see, I recognized that I could work at my own pace. I could make money according to my own ability. I could be relatively independent of my bosses. So I went through the training. You know what? It turned out I was good at that. I was good at selling cars. Now, it helped that I got the job and then we had the first energy crisis. Many of you aren't old enough to remember, but there was a time in the 70s when people actually lined up for hours to buy gasoline, when people who had big cars would give them away for nothing in order to buy a small car. I happened to be one of those guys selling small cars, so it worked out very, very well for me. And we couldn't keep enough cars, and things were going great until one day, my boss came to me and he said, you know, I got to be honest with you. His name was Sal Arrigo. I said, okay, Sal, what's the problem? He goes, the sight of you makes me want to vomit. And I said, well, what did I do? And he said this, and I won't use the word he used. Anybody who's married to a woman like you makes me sick. And I want no part of it. Get out of here. Now, if we were living in this time when that happened, I could have owned the dealership, but it wasn't like that back then. And so I got fired. And I was devastated. I'd never been fired from anything without me being the cause, you know, something that I was good at, something that I wanted to do. But I got fired from that job, and I didn't know what else I was going to do. So Paula and I continued for about 6 months of really difficult times. We hadn't enough food to eat. We didn't have enough clothes to wear. We had a baby at that time. Our life was very, very difficult. And just by chance, one day, Paula and I were sitting at a delicatessen having a sandwich, and one of my old team managers walked in, and his name was Jim. I said, hey, Jim, how you doing? He goes, Ron, how are you? And I said, well, things aren't going very well, you know, since Sal let me go. I don't know what to do. And he goes, well, today I was named general manager of the store. Sal got fired. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, would you like to come back to work? And I said, would I ever? And he said, just two things. One, you got to get a haircut. Oh, bummer. Okay, I'll do that. The other is, I had to go get a license. They had salesman's licenses at the time. Well, a haircut back then cost $5. A salesman's license cost $5, and I was about $10 short. So I called my mom. She gave me the money. She gave me another $20. And then she turned her back while I went and raided my dad's closet because, you see, I didn't have any clothes. And fortunately, my dad was not much taller than I was. And so I went in, I got a dress shirt, I got a tie, I got a belt, and I stole some socks and some stuff so I could go to work. Got my haircut, got my salesman's license, and went to work. And I did really, really well. But you see, there's one problem. I only had clothes for one day. Now, I was pretty industrious back in those days, and this is what I did. I went to Sears. Now, I don't know if it's like that now, but back then, Sears would take anything back. And so every single day for 2 weeks until I got paid, I went back and exchanged all the clothes that I wore that day. I put tape on the bottom of my shoes so that they wouldn't appear to be worn. White tape. I had these white patent leather shoes with black soles with white adhesive tape on the bottom. I had plaid pants and a white belt. And I had my dad's very conservative shirt and tie. And I'd get off work every night at 6 or 8, whatever time we closed the dealership. I'd walk the short distance up the street to the Sears, find a salesman that I hadn't spoken to. Say, you know, these shoes, they just don't feel quite right. Can I get those? And every night for 2 weeks until I got a paycheck, I exchanged clothes. Even back then, I had an aversion to being tacky, so I didn't want to wear the same clothes. Well, I found that I could do this and do it pretty well. And for the first time in my life, though I wasn't responsible enough to take advantage of it, I began to make enough money to put food on the table to make sure that we had an apartment. We moved to an apartment. And I thought, boy, that's it. Things are really going to get better now. But they didn't get better. They didn't get better. God had a plan that I can look back now and see was at work way back then. You see, I still had family that thought I was the crazy hippie of the family. I was still married to a woman who was a different color. I still didn't have widespread acceptance. And I got angry. And I made a commitment. I said, Paula, we're leaving. Now, we couldn't go too far because I didn't want to go anywhere where it snowed. And so, let's get in a truck and go to Arizona. And we went to Mesa, Arizona. I got a job, started to do very, very well. But there was a point when it dawned on me that I had to get serious about work. If I was ever going to really be able to provide for my family, we had two boys at that time. If I was ever going to really be able to provide for my family, then I needed to make a living, a good living. I needed to secure their future. And so I decided one day, almost matter-of-factly, I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I might as well do it. No more fooling around. I'm going to put everything I have into making a success of this career. And from that point forward, guys, everything I touched turned to gold. Everything I touched turned to gold. I learned a really valuable lesson from one of the owners of the dealership that I worked at when we first went to Mesa, Arizona. I had been very successful as a salesman. They wanted to promote a manager, and I just demanded that they give me the job. I knew they couldn't afford to lose me, so I walked in and I said, look, I want that job. If I don't do a better job than the guy that you're getting rid of, and if I don't do it instantly, then I'll be out of here. You can get rid of me forever. They gave me the job as a used car manager. Now, you guys have to understand, used car manager job, it would have been a difficult one for me because I don't know the front end of a car from the back end of a car. Somebody told me that you tell the difference between a six-cylinder and eight-cylinder by counting the posts on the battery. I believed them. I'd raise hoods and start one, two, three times two. This is six-cylinder. Somebody said, no, it's not. Well, yeah, it is. And they found out that I didn't know anything at all. But I had a really good eye for what a car was worth and what we could sell it for. I had a good eye for what would sell, and instantly, the used car business tripled. Instantly, it tripled. After my first month, a resounding success. I'm pretty proud of myself by now. The owner, his name was Britt Smith. He's from Dallas, Texas, but living obviously in Arizona at the time, walked over, and you know, he just wanted to do a nice thing. He taught me this principle about being a servant, about learning to work under authority. But he did it, unlike Christ, he did it in a very, very harsh way. He walked over just to be nice, and he said, Ron, I want to congratulate you. I'm just thrilled that we chose you to be the used car manager. I'm proud of you, son. I'm proud of the job you're doing. And I looked at him and I said, Mr. Smith, don't worry about a thing. I'll take care of you. He looked at me, his smile turned to absolute anger, indignation. And you know what he said? He said, son, I was a millionaire when I met you, and I'll be a millionaire when you're long gone. You ever want to take something you said back and stuff it in? Well, that's exactly what happened. But that was my first lesson engineered by God way back then on working under authority. See, my job wasn't to take care of anybody. My job was to do what He told me to do the way He told me to do it. Isn't that our life with Christ? Our job is to do what He's called us to do the way He's called us to do it. No opinions, no attitude, no alternatives. Just plow the course. Just finish. Just do it His way. You see, that's what authority is all about. Well, I learned that lesson fairly quickly because I'm a pretty practical guy. And I began to get even more successful. Our used car business continued to grow to the point where a lot of people wanted to hire me. It was just about 6 years later when I got an opportunity to be a manager at a store, a new car manager, which is a better paying job back then, at a Toyota Oldsmobile store right up the street. I took a job. The guy that was my boss was just a year or two older than I was. His dad really was the dealer, but his dad was 83 at the time. And so he, in fact, was the guy who was running the show, but he didn't really want to run the show at all. He was a cowboy and he just wanted to play. And he said, "Well, Ron, I want to hire you and I'll groom you to be the general manager." And I thought, hey, great job. My very first day at work was Halloween day at the new dealership. I just got introduced as a new manager, and then I saw Chris, who was the owner's son, leave hurriedly. I got a phone call about 10 minutes later, and he said, "Ron, you're in charge until I get back. My dad just died." I didn't see him for 2 months. And there I was running a store with people who didn't know me, people that I didn't know, and really no idea at all about how to do it. So I was just kind of thrown in the middle. And you know what? Everything worked. Now, some of you won't appreciate the difficulty of that, because that was when Oldsmobile was making diesels. And every day was a battlefield at work. I had to go to my office and I had to get through all these smoking, leaking oil diesels sitting in our service drive and angry customers. So I had to learn about how to deal with angry customers. I had to learn about how to deal with the manufacturer who didn't want to satisfy the angry customers. And so it was a real baptism under fire. But things just kept getting better and better and better. And finally, because my reputation was beginning to increase, I got another opportunity. A guy called me and said, "I'm going to open a new dealership in Phoenix. It's going to be a big dealership, and I want you to run it for me." And I said, "Well, when are you going to open?" He says, "Well, I'm going to open in April of 1984, and I want you to be the guy." "Okay, I'll do it. You have to pay me a lot of money." He goes, "That's okay." So I went and opened this dealership, and it was 17 straight months until we failed to sell more cars than the month before. 17 straight months. And at the end of 17 months, we were selling 1,000 cars a month. And we were doing it with a customer satisfaction rating that was unheard of in the industry. And everybody, not only locally, but everybody nationally in terms of manufacturers, wanted to know how we were doing it. They would send their people to our sales training seminars, the sales training seminars that I developed, to find out how we were doing it. And pretty soon they stopped trying to do it on their own, and they would just send their people to our sales training seminars. At one time in this dealership had 430 employees. I felt like the mayor of a little city. And everything couldn't have been better. But that's when my destruction, my downfall really began. You see, I got proud. I got arrogant. And I thought, well, you know, I'm making this guy a lot of money. I need to go do this on my own. I talked to the manufacturers. I was working for Nissan at the time. And I said, "How about you find a dealership for me?" So I got just a dealership. It's in California. So I made a trip over to California, talked to a guy. First time in my life I was ever intimidated by a guy. He picked me up at the airport, drove me to the marina, and we had a meeting on his yacht. And then I was smitten. I thought, this is me. I need one of these yachts. And I know how to get it. And I went to work for him, but there was just some uneasiness. I just didn't really trust the guy. So this is what I told him. I said, "You know what? How about I just work for you for 6 months? I don't think this is the opportunity that I want to buy into. You're in trouble. I'll help you out, and then I'll train your son so he'll be able to take over for you because he wanted to get away." And so I did that. But at the same time, I was still looking for another dealership. Well, the opportunity came close to my hometown of Pomona. It's Ontario, California. And I went and I became partners with the man at Ontario Nissan in Ontario, California. And his dealership was about to go under. He needed me desperately. He needed the credibility with the manufacturers and with the banks that hiring me would have provided. And I just told him plainly, "Look, I'm the minority partner. You've got the money, but you're about to lose this. Just stay out of my way." And he agreed. And once again, things couldn't have gone better. See, I'd once made a vow that I was never coming home to California. Because of the way my family treated me, I was never coming home until I was rich and successful. Until everybody knew. So I came home the conquering hero. Now, there was a lot of things in my life that were beginning to turn upside down. I was gaining weight very, very quickly. The job at the Toyota Oldsmobile dealership in Arizona had one condition with it. The dealer wanted me to go to lunch with him every day. And boy, these heavy lunches. And you work 100 hours a week and you don't get much exercise. And so I began to gain a lot of weight. I began to become more and more insensitive to my wife and to my children. I became more and more involved in me. Everything was about me. And when I sunk everything I had into this dealership in Ontario and everything began to go perfectly, man, I thought I was on the fast track. 1987, in terms of business, was the best year of my life. Everything went perfect. And then my grandmother died. And we were crushed. No sooner had she died than my mother got sick. And as my mother was getting sick and she had a mysterious illness that nobody understood, she was in a great deal of pain. My partner stole from me. He didn't have to steal. All he had to do was talk to me. I felt so violated. I felt so vulnerable. For the first time in my life, I had been taken advantage of. I had been played for a fool. You see, this man, I'd been warned against going into business with him. But in my arrogance, I believed that he needed me so badly that he couldn't survive without me, without thinking rationally that I built his financial health back to a place where he didn't need anybody. And one day, he came in and I said, look, I'm going to buy you out. He said, no, legally, I have the option, you're out of here. I had no money at that point because I'd been gambling, living from paycheck to paycheck. Now, when you're making a lot of money, living from paycheck to paycheck provides a very, very nice lifestyle. We were spending everything that I brought in and more. And we were doing it because I needed the appearance of even more success than I was experiencing. My ego needed to be constantly fed. And so, I owned racehorses. I was at the track every opportunity that I could be there, I was there. And gambling began to take control of my life. And when he closed the door on me at the business I built for him, I was devastated. And that's when I began to sink into an abyss that was so deep. Now let me backtrack, because it's important to understand what was going on. While everything was going really, really well and then beginning to deteriorate, there was something strange going on in my house. You see, it was in 1978, some people in Mesa, Arizona introduced my wife to Jesus Christ. I was adamantly opposed because of you church people, you know. And Paula found Jesus. And she told me she found Jesus. And I said, well, I don't care who you found, just keep him out of my house. I forbade her from reading the Bible in my home. I forbade her from talking to my children about Jesus. I didn't want to hear anything about it. When she would try to witness to me, I would become so angry that I would be almost unable to be communicated with. It absolutely made me so angry because it was something that I could not control. And one day she came to me. You guys have heard the story. One day she came to me and she said, Ron, I got to tell you something. I read something in the Bible today. I don't want to hear about your Bible. She said, well, you got to listen to me one time. I've read something that I understand, and here's what it is. God, in the book of Malachi, says he hates divorce. And so, Ron, I will never divorce you. Now, what you do, but I will never divorce you. You see, like a lot of troubled marriages, we threaten each other with divorce. Now, I never really wanted to divorce my wife. I never really intended, in spite of my threats, to do so. I think there were times when she threatened it where she meant it. But then she came to that passage and she said, if God hates divorce and I love God, I have to hate what he hates. And so, Ron, I will never divorce you. And you've heard me say I spent the next 5 years literally. This is not a symbolic thing. Literally, I spent the next 5 years trying to change her mind. And as my life was deteriorating, her life had joy. Now, there wasn't a lot of depth to her faith. She had to be kind of a secret agent Christian because I'd never let her talk about it. She had people all over praying for me. My grandmother, who had been praying for me, was now gone. My mom, who became a late in life Christian, I didn't know about it, was now gone. She was Paula's best friend. And Paula had nobody but Jesus. And she had people in little Bible study groups or little church groups praying for her husband. And I didn't know anything about it. I'd work 90 to 100 hours a week, every week. Come home, kind of collapse in the easy chair and turn on TV. We had one of those 50-inch televisions, and I'd just keep turning up the volume. She and the kids would try to talk to me, and I didn't want to be talked to, and so I just kept turning up the volume until the volume was so loud nobody could hear anything except the volume on the TV. It was my way of saying to them, get away from me, I don't want to hear from you. And they would come to me, all of them, and say, but Dad, we just want to spend some time with you. And I would say stupid things, guys, like, don't you realize I'm tired from working? And Paula would say, honey, I don't want your money. I don't want this stuff. I'm doing this for you, I'd say. Don't you understand? You're so ungrateful. I work, I slave, I do it for you. Guys, that was a lie from hell. I was doing it for me. And I just shut them out of my life altogether. Because I didn't want to be confronted with one thing, her joy. You see, I was a professional at making people miserable. And no matter what I tried, I couldn't make her miserable. It's amazing the pain that you cause people in times like that. Pain that you're not even aware of. It was years later, after I became a Christian, that I found out my wife nearly became an alcoholic because of me and the stress that I created in the home. I'd call on the cell phone, honey, I'm coming home, have dinner ready. Well, it took an hour at least because of traffic, sometimes as many as 2 or 2.5 hours to get the 39 miles home. And as soon as I started calling, Paula started drinking to try to soothe her nerves before I got there. Can you imagine the insanity of a life that would drive the people you're supposed to love to that kind of a lifestyle? And yet that was the tension, the situation that I created in my own home. I'm doing it for you, I would say. Completely unaware that she was slipping into what could have turned into alcoholism very easily. And it continued on and on and on until one day I could no longer deal with the consequences that were beginning to burden my life. You see, I got into a place after my business fell apart where I was still working for other people, still making a very, very good living. Making money has always been easy for me. But guys, I was gambling $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a week on football games. You see, prior to coming to California, my gambling had been confined to horses. And believe it or not, I actually did fairly well. I at least broke even or did a little bit better than breaking even with the horses I owned and with the horses that I bet on. And it was kind of a controlled environment. I didn't have enough time to be there as much as I would like to be there. And while I gambled large amounts of money, I was doing okay. But when I came to California and I found I could bet football games on the phone, believe it or not, I was so naive, I didn't know there were bookies out there. I found a bookie who wanted to take my bets. And I went from $1,000 a week and on, it was just a very few months where literally I was looking at $60,000, $70,000, even $80,000 a week. Now I was still making a lot of money, I still had some money, but at that rate it doesn't last very long. And pretty soon the guys that were taking my bets wanted to get paid. My friends, at least I thought they were my friends, became pretty aggressive. And I began to tell lies because I didn't have any money. Oh man, you know what happened? And it's amazing how creative you can be, the stories that you can come up with when you think somebody's going to hurt you if you don't. And I began to run away. I was getting so fat that I was in danger, I think, of losing my life in terms of heart attack, blood pressure, I don't know what, a stroke. And yet the pressure was constantly there. And I began to make some very, very serious mistakes. Mistakes that, except for the grace of God, could have put me in jail. But you see, God had a plan for me. He was in control, even as my life began to fall apart. And there was another interesting phenomenon going on around me at the same time. I'm completely oblivious to it. But as being the person in charge, I had the authority to hire people. And I'd interview them. And think, wow, that's the person I want to hire, put them on, and I'd find out the next day they were a Christian. And I thought, well, why are you bringing a Bible to work? This isn't a church. We're here to sell cars. We're here to make money. And they would say, oh, don't worry, I won't read it here. I'll just read it on my lunch breaks. You see, I love God, and this is where I find out about Him. And they would say something foolish like, do you want to know Him? My wife has been trying that for years now. You see, for 13 years, my wife hung in there and she'd been praying. For 13 years, living a life that was an absolute living hell that I created. And yet she'd purposed in her heart to obey God. She'd purposed in her heart to stay with me no matter what. And she just decided to pray. In that process of praying, it's amazing how your heart begins to line up with God's heart. She stopped praying, Lord, kill my husband and bring me the Christian man that you want. Paula's ambition was humble. It was small. You know what she wanted? She'd say, oh God, just give me a husband that'll take me to church. Boy, does God answer prayers? But her life, as miserable as it was committed to God. And the maturity that began to develop as she prayed, as she obeyed God, as she hung in there, the maturity began to change her. And pretty soon, she began to pray what I think is the most courageous prayer I've ever heard. She would say, Lord, whatever you have to do to bring him to Jesus, do it. I take my hands off. I put him in your hands. And if you have to take everything away from him to bring him to faith in Jesus Christ, do it. And I'll get out of your way. And then Satan, because he's always busy, guys, comes beside Paula and reminds her of something that she hadn't thought of. Well, it seems so obvious to us, but it's something that out of a pure heart she never considered. You know what it was? It was this. Satan spoke to her heart and said, you know, if he loses everything he has, you lose everything you have. And God then spoke to her heart and said, is that okay? Will you trust me if you lose everything? And Paul asked a very reasonable question of the Lord. She said, God, now remember, she's watching me deteriorate before her very eyes. I think I have everybody fooled. She says, how much lower does he have to go? I don't think I can take it if I have to watch him go any lower. And the Lord spoke to her heart, as surely as I'm speaking to you, and he said, much lower. You see, I was a very proud, stubborn man. I was in control of my own destiny, or so I thought. I was going to be the one that would fix it. Paula would say, Ron, unless you turn to Jesus, I don't want to hear about you, Jesus. I need money. I'll figure out how to get money. I've always been able to get money. But then the hand of God was right there again, and I couldn't recognize it. You know what, guys? I suddenly got stupid. I don't know how it happened, but everything I could do before better than anybody, I couldn't do anything. Every decision I made, instead of being the right one, was the wrong one. Every dealership that I tried to turn around went further into the toilet. And suddenly people began to look at me, what's the matter with you? You're the guy with the great reputation. You're the one that we're paying all this money to fix the problem. And things got worse and worse and worse. And then, the worst thing yet happened. I don't know how many of you remember, I was a general manager of a Cadillac store in Orange County, California, and the Gulf War broke out. And for a store that was doing quite well, selling 90 Cadillacs a month, making a lot of money on each car, suddenly wasn't getting a customer a day even to look at a car. You see, everybody was going to take kind of a wait-and-see approach. War's going on in the Middle East. It's a fuel crisis possibility. We're not going to buy a big car. Conservative Orange County people said, I'm going to keep my money in savings. And we went from 90 cars a month to less than 10. And people began to be being laid off. I was the one doing the laying off. And you know what? I was honest enough to come to the conclusion that the dealership could no longer support me. That's a hard one. And then things really caved in. I went home one day. I knew that every day that I went to work could be the day where the people that I worked for found out the bad stuff that I'd done. I could come to work any morning and be met by police cars and hauled off to jail for some of the things that I'd done. And the pressure was overwhelming. So I left the office one afternoon, drove home in my company-owned car, had $300 in my pocket, parked it in the garage, and started to run away. It was February of 1991. I told a friend before I left work, his name was Roy, I said, Roy, call my family in the morning, tell Paula if I haven't been home, tell her I'm okay. But I just couldn't face her with the things I'd done. I couldn't stand in front of my boys and face them with the truth of the horrible things that I'd done. But I'm okay, I love them, but I had to run away. He tried to talk me out of it, of course, didn't work. I went home, parked the car, and began to walk. I didn't know where I was going. I figured I'd go to the bus station. I really didn't have any idea. You see, for several weeks prior to that, the bookies that I owed money to were chasing me. They were parked outside my house waiting for an opportunity to get me alone, if you know what I mean. I knew they were looking for me. I knew eventually the opportunity would arise where they'd find me. And I couldn't see a way out. And so I began to run away. Now, that wasn't the first place I'd tried to run. I thought I could get sympathy by going to a program. I went to Gamblers Anonymous. A man stood up, welcomed me, introduced somebody else, and this other person got up and said, Hi, my name is whatever his name was. I'm a sick, compulsive gambler. And I owe my life to Gamblers Anonymous. You see, for the first time in my life, I'm free of gambling. And I haven't gambled in 7 months, 6 days, and 3 hours. And I looked at him like he was the most pitiful example of a man in the whole world. I thought, well, that's stupid. I mean, that's not freedom. You see, God was at work in my heart. I talked to him afterwards and I said, well, you said you owe your life to Gamblers Anonymous. How many meetings do you go to? Every day, sometimes twice. And I said, that's not freedom. I was hoping to come so I could find direction, find help. And all I find is people in bondage to something else. Some of them would talk about a higher power. Some of them would even talk about God. There was even one man who talked about Jesus Christ, but they didn't let it get too personal, you know. And I realized that Gamblers Anonymous wasn't going to deliver me. Now, the one benefit that Gamblers Anonymous had is it made me feel better. You see, I found out after sitting through 2 hours of testimonies that there were people a lot worse off than I was. But then I had to go deal with my own problems. And they were always right there. I'd wake up screaming at night. I'd wake up in cold sweats. And yet I was telling everybody in the world I was in control. Now, I want you to understand, my wife knew that things were going awfully wrong, but nobody else did. I put on the best front possible. There may be some of you here tonight who believe that nobody else knows the pain you're in, who believe that nobody else knows your life is messed up, and like me, you have too much pride to go to somebody and say, I need God's help. I can't get out of this any other way. I want you to know that God will be there when you call out to Him. I also want you to know that there is no other way. Pride goeth before destruction. And it was never more true than in my own life. You see, I only got about a block and a half away when I took my walk, actually running away from home. And suddenly I was overwhelmed with despair and hopelessness. And I had no place to turn to. And God the Holy Spirit brought something. I didn't know it was Him. I didn't know anything about Him. But I know now it was Him who brought to my heart and my mind the recollection of my wife living in the misery that I created for her. All I saw was joy. And her joy got greater and greater. Physically, she grew stronger. Emotionally and spiritually, she grew stronger. She became more independent of me as she became more dependent upon God. And I couldn't destroy her as I destroyed myself and everybody else. And so in an instant, I cried out for Paul is Jesus. I didn't know anything else about him. All I could do was say, if you're real, I need Paul is Jesus in my life. Now, it'd be a great story if I could tell you that he appeared to me on Mountain Avenue like he appeared to the Apostle Paul. He didn't. But you know what did happen? Instantly, I knew two things. I knew that I was forgiven of my sins. I didn't know the theology. I couldn't have explained to you how or why it happened. All I could know for sure is that I was going to heaven. Somebody would say, are you a Christian? Yeah. What's a Christian? Don't know. I'm one. Well, how do you know? I just know my sins have been forgiven. Somebody say, how do you know? Well, I just know. I don't know how I know. I just know. I knew. As this huge burden was lifted from my shoulders, I knew that I was going to heaven. Now, guys, you got to understand, a proud man who's always worked for what he's earned couldn't possibly understand that. How could I be going to heaven? I haven't done anything good yet. In the culture we live in, there's a lot of you think you have to do good before God brings you to the good. No, it's just the other way around. You can't do good until He does. And I knew that I was going to heaven. The second thing I knew was even more practical. My mind works in very practical ways. The second thing I knew was that if this man I met was able to forgive me of all my horrible sins, then I owed him the rest of my life. And I knew that I would never again be a day without serving Him. I knew it. I got up from the street and up in California and went back home. And because I was still proud, I pretended like everything was okay. You want to know how stupid proud I was? I was so filled with pride that I didn't tell my wife for 3 months that I was born again because I didn't want her to think she was right. I knew if I said, honey, I found the Lord, she'd say, I know it. I told you. See, she wouldn't have done that at all. She just would have rejoiced with me and over me. But you see how the proud mind works. We think we've got to do it all on our own. We think that to admit that we're sinners is a weakness. We think that to admit we need someone else, even God, proves that we aren't really men at all. The same principle applies to some of you women. We think we've got to be good. We think we've got to earn people's favor. And yet God is willing right now, tonight, to pour out His unmerited favor on you and through your life, if only you'll let Him reach your heart with His infinite love. It would be a wonderful story if I could tell you that I went back home, I hugged my wife, and we were a later version of Ozzy and Harriet from that day forward, but it didn't work out that way. You see, the consequences of my sin were catching up to me. The bookies were still looking for me. The people who I worked for didn't want me to be there anymore. My source of money was cut off. And I owed all of these terrible people all of this money. And I didn't know what to do. And so, like many of you, when you don't know what to do, you do things in the flesh. You do things your way. Because it's the only way you know. I mean, you met God, but He's a stranger. And so you don't trust Him yet because you don't know Him very well yet. You don't know that you can trust Him. And you just dig a deeper hole. Well, let me briefly explain to you some of the consequences that we went through to get to the place where we are. You see, we were homeless. And my youngest son, senior year in high school, from being rich and having everything, my kids having anything they wanted all the time, suddenly we were homeless. Have you ever sat down to explain to your children why you don't have food for them? Our family ate oatmeal every day because there was nothing else to eat. When we were able to get a little bit of money, we had peanut butter and jelly. I'd always have to park going downhill because I was in danger of running out of gas. I had no gas, so we'd just coast to where we had to go. God humbled me in the most glorious ways, difficult at the time, but glorious. My oldest son bought Paula and me a gym membership so we'd have a place to shower because we were living in a garage without a bathroom. And so we'd get up every single morning and go to the gym so we could shower, and I'd go try to find a job. I did find a job. God was with me. He began to help a little bit, but the mountain that I'd created was so impossible. There were a couple of things that God did. The first thing He did almost instantly was speak to my heart. Now, guys, I don't want to sound goofy. I don't hear audible voices. God doesn't speak to us that way, but there's just times when God speaks something to your heart that you know is God. And God, in His infinite wisdom, spoke to a control freak in the one area that He'd completely lost control of, His physicality, my body. I was so fat. God spoke to my heart one evening, just before I went to bed. Wonderful things happen when you spend a little bit of time with the Lord. And He said, get your body in shape. If you'd asked me anything else, solve your problems, make money, get rid of your debts, if you'd asked me anything else, I would have said, okay, I'm a can-do guy, Lord, I'll go do it. But He put His finger instantly on the one thing that I'd lost the ability or even the willingness to try to control. My body. And I simply said, Lord, I can't do that for You. I've tried every diet known to man. I've tried every exercise program known to man. I can't do that for You. If You want me to get my body in shape, You have to do it for me. And He took the challenge. I'd wake up in the morning with the sound of an alarm, still dark outside. And you know how we do, we turn it off, we kind of struggle for it and hit it. Ah, I'll blow it off tomorrow, I'll do it tomorrow. Well, I don't know how to explain this except to say that my next conscious recollection would be walking on the street in gym clothes. And I say, how did I get here? And I really would have no recollection. God was pushing me supernaturally just to prove to me that He could do it. And the weight began to pour off. I didn't diet. The only thing I did differently was I stopped drinking 30 or 40 Coca-Colas a day and replaced it with water. I began taking long walks. And actually, I tried to run at first. I could only get about a half a block. I was so out of shape. But we lived on a mountain, kind of, and so it was downhill. And so I'd start running downhill. And I'd get to where I could go farther and farther and farther. And I'd have to walk back. And that's when I developed the habit that to this day I enjoy more than anything else in my life, walking with God. I began to pray, began to pour out my heart. I began to cry, God, why does this hurt so much? I'm following You. It's not supposed to be this hard. And yet there was something in me that knew, practically speaking, that I had to deal with the consequences. The mess I made was my fault. God had to allow me to suffer the consequences to teach me the lessons I needed to learn. And His weight began to pour off of me. God had promised me a new body, and I watched it begin to develop. Now, it's not like a great body or anything, but compared to what it was, I'm thrilled. And you know what? I haven't gained any weight in 10 years. Because God took control. And because I'm smart, I thought, well, God, if You can do that, You can do anything. What's next? And you see, in my zeal without knowledge, I made some bad decisions. And things didn't get better. You see, I continued to lie to my bookies. And yet God was gracious and moved even in my sin. Every day for a year, and it was almost a year to the day, I lied. Every night I'd come home and cry. God, I'm so sorry. I don't want to lie. Please forgive me. And then I'd convince myself I was okay, but I knew I was going to lie again the next day. The bookies would show up, got my money? Oh, man, you can't believe what happened. No, but tomorrow I'll get... And over and over and over, I kept repeating it. My heart was being torn apart inside as I told these lies. And one day, and we all have to get here, guys, whatever your sin is, you have to get here. One day I got to the place where I said, God, I would rather die than tell one more lie. I can't do this to You anymore, Lord. I can't pretend that I'm a Christian and continue to lie and ask for Your forgiveness. So, Lord, with Your help, I'll not tell one more lie. That was a Sunday night. Monday is usually a pretty good day at work. I wasn't going to see my bookie until Tuesday or Wednesday. So I had a little cushion. I went to work that day. Okay, God, it's me and you. I'm never going to lie again. Knowing I wasn't going to see him until Tuesday or Wednesday. You know how we build in those cushions for us? Boy, when you're in trouble, the whole 3 days seems like eternity. My secretary knocks on my door. Ron, Dave's here. Dave was my bookie. No, it's not Tuesday. It's not Wednesday. You see, I'm not going to lie tomorrow. And right then, Satan is there. Right then, Satan is there. And he says, you weren't ready for this today. Just one more lie. You tell the truth tomorrow, but just one more lie today. And you know, I bought it. I said, okay, just one more lie, but tomorrow. And then instantly God grabbed a hold of my heart and I said, no. And guys, I owe this man, I don't know, tens of thousands of dollars. Used to be a friend. He walked into my office, sat across the desk. I was very nervous. He was angry. I said, Dave, I got to talk to you. I got to tell you something. Ron, no, let me talk first. I said, no, Dave, you don't understand. I got to do this now. I'm not going to do it. And finally, he slapped my desk. Shut up. I did. And he said, you know, I used to like talking to you. I used to like being your friend. Our relationship used to be good. And now every time I talk to you, you lie to me. And I'm absolutely sick of it. I want you to promise me never to lie to me again. And I said, okay. I've been lying. I'll never lie to you again. He said, okay, I forgive the debt. You see, God is there, guys, in miraculous ways. My youngest son, Terry, straight-A student in high school, president of his class and all everything, volleyball player. We felt God said he was to go to Pepperdine. Pepperdine cost $25,000 a year. Then it would eventually end up about $28,000 before he was through. It's the only college he applied to. A great faith. Terry, God said, go to Pepperdine. You're going to go to Pepperdine. Now remember, he's not a believer. God's showing off not just for me, but for him. My brother-in-law came to me and said, Ron, you're going to break Terry's heart. He's not going to be able to go to Pepperdine because you can't afford it. And so you got to tell him the truth. Enroll him at the junior college. And I took a stand by faith. No, Dennis, he's going to go to Pepperdine because God said. Well, how's he going to do it? I don't know, but God said. And then we got a notice in the mail that Terry was one of 100 finalists for a Southern California Edison scholarship of $20,000. And I thought, oh, Lord, you're so good. Boy, are we going to show them. And then we got another letter that said he was now one of 7 finalists for 2 scholarships. Oh, of course, he deserves it, Lord. He's my son. You're going to move on his behalf. And then he didn't get it. Paul and I, again, on a Sunday night, we were going to drive to the movie and we never got out of the car. We just sat there and cried out to God. With an honest heart, I said, Lord, I'll do anything except tell Terry he can't go to Pepperdine. We believed it was you. We believed that you wanted to send there, that you wanted to show off for him. And Lord, I just can't tell him that I forfeited his future. And I came to the conclusion that in my flesh, I would do whatever it took to get him into Pepperdine. Making money, again, is not hard for me. I had already planned to go to Bible college. I said, I'll put that off because Terry's got to go to Pepperdine. Next morning, I called the financial aid office at Pepperdine and talked to a guy named Armand. Armand had said, been very helpful during the time Terry was up for the scholarship. We talked to him several times. I finally got him on the phone. He wanted to talk to me. And I finally said, no, you don't understand. Terry didn't get the scholarship. And now you got to help me figure out a way to get him into Pepperdine. I'll work. You want $10,000 a month? I'll get $10,000 a month. Whatever it takes, I'll do it. He said, Mr. Arbaugh, stop talking for a minute. I have something to tell you. And I said, well, what? And he said, well, we were just waiting to hear what the scholarship committee for Edison said. Because we want Terry here, and we have already awarded him a 4-year scholarship. full tuition, room, and board for as long as he keeps at least a C average. Terry graduated from Pepperdine in 4 years with a 3.6, I think, average GPA. You see, God is there. He wants to move on your behalf. I was in Bible college, still didn't have any money. We were able finally to move to a one-bedroom apartment in Ontario, California, move out of the garage. God was dealing with me up on the mountain at Bible college. He was dealing with Paula down in the valley in Ontario, preparing us all for exactly the same thing, March 4th, 1994. When God said, begin to pray for the people of San Antonio, Texas. I knew I'd been called to be a pastor. I assumed that I was going to go to San Antonio to start a church. I began to pray for you. 2 weeks later, God filled me in on the reason I'm going to be there waiting for you. Oh, Lord, you're so good. You trust me with the church, even in a strange city. Lord, we're going to go and we're going to be happy. Paula, God gave me direction. Oh, honey, what is it? We're going to San Antonio. I don't think so, she said. My faith giant of a wife suddenly turned to mush. Our family, our church, our friends, all in Southern California. And God said, no, I'm going to pick you up and move you. And I said, men, something that was the Lord speaking through me, because my flesh wanted to say, but what's the matter with you, woman? But I said, honey, until we are agreed, we're not going anywhere. And I trusted God to work on her heart. And on Easter Sunday, that very same year, or the next year, 1995, we loaded up a truck that we paid $1 for. And headed out across the desert on Interstate 10 East on our way to San Antonio to meet you. Now, guys, the purpose of this tonight wasn't to glorify my sin. The purpose of this was to share with you a God who rescues, a God who delivers. You see, Colossians chapter 1, verse 13 describes exactly what happened to me. The same thing has happened to many of you. The same thing can happen to all of you. For He, God, has rescued me from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son He loves. And He did that while I was running away. He didn't do it after I was a pastor. He didn't do it after I had committed to be good. He did it while I was running away. You see, I don't know whether Jesus is in just really good shape or I just was really fat and out of shape, but no matter how long I tried to run away from Him, He was always right there. He was there before I got saved in the people around me. He was there in the wife God put in my home. He was there when I sat my children down at 16 and 18 years of age. And the dad who had all the answers said, son, I'm wrong. What are you wrong about, Dad? Everything I've ever taught you is wrong. I don't know what's right yet. I don't have the answers, kids. I'll fill you in as I get filled in from heaven. But everything I taught you is wrong. Men, ladies, can you swallow your pride to admit that your way's not working? Can you encourage others in your life to stop running? Can you say, you know what, it's okay to be a sinner, because if I admit it, I'm just like everybody else, a sinner who can be saved by grace. You see, as long as you think there's something you need to do, as long as you think there's something you have to be, God can't find you. And your life is going to get more and more miserable. The pain quotient is going to increase. Right now, God is creating circumstances in your life to make it impossible to live without Him. And you can rebel, you can run, but you'll never, ever be able to run far enough, fast enough. Because God is everywhere you go. When I go to the depths, David said, you're there. When I go to the heavens, you're there. I go to the desert, you're already there. You go before me. No matter where I ran, God was there. And you know what? He was never there with, you're a miserable excuse for a man, Ron. He was always there with the come to me. all you who labor and are heavy laden, I will give you rest. And there was a day, finally, when I needed the rest so desperately that I said, yes, Lord, I'll come to you on your terms. You don't need to know about Jesus. I only knew about Paul as Jesus. You don't need to clean up your life before you find him, because you can't. Flesh begets flesh, and the situation gets in your life the way it was in mine when the Lord spoke to Paul's heart, and she said, how much lower? And he said, much lower. If you're running away from God, the circumstances are going to get much worse. Because God loves you so much, he simply can't let your way work out. He loves you. He has a plan for you. If you're honest, you will admit that your plan isn't working out. And if you'll just for a minute set aside your insane pride and stop even thinking for a moment that things are going to work out your way, you'll meet a God who doesn't want to condemn you. You'll meet a God who died so he didn't have to judge you. You'll meet a God who will welcome you into his family and say, now we can begin working on the plan I have for you. You'll meet a God who will face the consequences of the mess you've made alongside you. A God who will never leave you or forsake you. A God who, instead of being disgusted by your sin, will embrace you because he won't want to remember it anymore. And the moment you say, God, I'm yours. Forgive me of my sins. I choose to follow you. Your slate is wiped completely clean. And that lifting of the burden of sin that I experienced in February of 1991 can be real for any and every one of you. And only God. His name is Jesus Christ. He's not the man upstairs. He's not the big guy. He's not, well, there's a God out there somewhere. He's not Buddha and he's not Confucius. He's not Muhammad. His name is Jesus. And he is the only one who can forgive sins. It's not church. You see, the one thing that has never changed about church, from my experience at Pomona First Baptist Church, is this. Church is still filled with hypocrites. And you know what's amazing? God loves you, hypocrite. And he doesn't care about all that duplicity. He doesn't care about anything except you surrendering your heart so that he can begin to work out his will in and through you. And when you say yes, I'll promise two things. One, though your consequences will not disappear. You made a mess of your life. Consequences follow messes. He will be with you through them all. And there'll be some times in the middle of those consequences when he will demonstrate his power in such a way that you know it could only be him. And you'll think, oh God, you really do love me. And it may not be in the form of a bookie forgiving a huge debt. It may not be in the form of somebody from college saying, no, we want your son here for all 4 years. You only wanted 1 year. We want him all 4 years. I'll pay for it all. It may not be that dramatic. But it may be. It's just that you'll never find out until you trust God. I promise you that he will be with you through the consequences. Promise number two, and I'll close with this, is that your life from this point forward will never be the same. You will live a life filled with passion, a life filled with joy, even in the middle of the darkest circumstances, a life filled with possibilities instead of impossibilities. A life, for the very first time, with direction. And I don't know about you, but direction is a good thing. You see, that's what the man said, wasn't it? Once I was lost, and now I'm found. Once I was stumbling around in the dark, but then somebody turned on the light. Once I was blind, and now I can see. Once I was alone, but now I'm not. God will begin to fill your life with people who love you from His heart, people who don't want anything from you, people who just want to hang with you because you're hanging out with Jesus. Guys, it is a wonderful life to live. It is available only in the person of Jesus Christ. And the sooner you come to realize that, the better off you will be in the people in your life that you've caused so much pain for. You see, God didn't bring me to Paula's house in March of 1970 to bring her pain. You know, I've never had to say, "I'm sorry to Paula." I have, but I've never had to say it. She's never asked me to do anything spectacular to prove that I love her. In fact, you know what the truth is? Before I got saved, she asked me every day if I loved her. She didn't have to ask anymore. And He's given me a life with her that is better than I ever dreamed possible. It is impossible apart from Christ. And He wants to do it for everyone. And finally, there was a time when Jesus came across some lepers. Leprosy, as you know, in the Bible is a type of sin. We all are lepers, spiritually speaking. Now, you may look good. You may look from the outward appearances as though there's no leprosy, no sin in you. You may look like you've got it all together. I know I did. But Jesus went to the lepers and touched them when nobody else did. You see, in the culture of the day, when a leper walked on the street, he had to yell, "Leper, leper," so people could get out of the way so they wouldn't be unclean. But Jesus would go up and put their face in His hands and say, "Be clean, be healed." And in the Gospel of Luke, there was a story about 10 of them. Only one came back to say thank you. This testimony is all about saying thank you. Christian who's been cleansed of your leprosy, say thank you to God often. Say thank you with a heart devoted to Him. Say thank you because of the great things He's done. If you're not a Christian, get ready to say thank you. God loves you. He's got a plan for your life. He wants to have you in His family, and He wants to have you tonight. Will you bow your heads and pray with me?